We're going to talk about Lazarus today. One of the things that came to me as I was preparing questions for this week was the fact that the Bible pointed out that Lazarus was the brother of Mary who anointed Jesus' feet. And I started thinking about that, why that is significant to point out in the Bible passage. Any thoughts?
Well, Jesus was well acquainted with Mary and Martha and Lazarus. They were, as one Bible thing put it, they were close friends or intimate friends with Jesus, close followers.
I saw a couple of commentaries that doubted that this could be that Mary that was the sister of Lazarus, because she was a sinner and she came to anoint Jesus' feet. Did anybody find anything contradicting that, or?
Yes.
Well, I doubt it, because Jesus didn't really care about, you know, people's background. What he cared about was where their heart was, and her heart was right. And I thought the significance was that Lazarus had a very humble and receptive thought in his family there. And that was a good influence on Lazarus.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's what we see with Mary.
I think there were two different Marys.
Right.
Not the same Mary.
Actually, three Marys.
And because this is Mary of Bethany, and then you have Mary of Magdala, and then you have Mary that was not named, well, the unnamed sinner. It's never given a name. And she's been connected with being Mary of Magdala, but all the Bible history I've been looking at points out there were three of them, but that this Mary was not the sinner, that Mary and Martha and Lazarus were people of means, and they lived in Bethany, and she was very devout to Jesus, and Jesus even pointed out that she followed the better way. So she's not the sinner referred to as washing Jesus' feet. In fact, the anointing of Jesus' feet happened after Lazarus is raised from the dead.
Well, I read both, and in other words, people don't really know. They feel there is some indication it might be Mary of Magdala. We don't know, but we do know one thing is that she was totally devoted to Jesus, and it said the fact that she would sit at his feet and learn from him was a sign that she was a disciple of Jesus. And it's also interesting because at that time that a woman could be a disciple of Jesus, and of course it was totally accepted, and we've been reading about that and talking about that at other Bible studies. Women were not shut out. And so it's interesting, and I did get the impression that she was healed of something, and perhaps of some kind of sins. And so maybe it doesn't really matter, except for her devotion. And because of that devotion, she did come, obviously, from a very devoted family of Christ Jesus, and perhaps for many deep reasons.
I got the impression, I thought that when Mary Magdalene anointed his feet, came into the dinner, I thought that was earlier, because in chapter 12, John, later, when Jesus sat down with Mary and Martha and Lazarus at the Passover time, Mary then bought this expensive oil and anointed Jesus' feet. So we're sort of talking about two different episodes. And she did the same kind of thing. She wiped his feet with her hair.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting. There are two episodes of Mary wiping Jesus' feet with her hair and very, very expensive oil.
I think it's possible it was the same Mary.
Yeah, I thought it was the same Mary. If it's not, I stand corrected, but I got the impression it was.
Historians are different.
I know in Science and Health, in the chapter of Christian Science Practice, when Mrs. Eddy talks about this incident where the woman walks in, uninvited, so to speak, she went on to say that this woman, later known as Mary Magdalene, so even Mary Baker Eddy identified her thus.
And whether there were two Marys, three Marys, to me it shows the fact that she anointed Jesus' feet whenever she did it, a tremendous humility and devotion to the Christ and a receptivity to the truth. And for Lazarus to have that influence in his family was a great help to him, I'm sure.
And that's really the significant point, instead of counting the
Mary. Exactly, that's the takeaway.
You know, where's the heart?
Yeah, and I mean, there were many commentaries who thought it was not the same, but then I read another one who was quite sure, probably so, they felt. So it just depends on what you read.
I always thought it was the same Mary. I mean, if it's not, I would be surprised. But whether she is or not, I mean, for me, I think it's important to recognize what she saw in Jesus. If she was the same Mary, from the beginning, I think she saw something about Jesus that made her to start wiping Jesus' feet with the most expensive oil. But I think there's something, I mean, when I read that story, there's something that always struck me. When Lazarus passed away and was put in the tomb for 3 days, and Jesus came, when Jesus heard the news, he came over. She met Jesus at the door. One of the first things she told Jesus was, "Master, if you were here, my brother would not pass away." Which means she recognized who Jesus was from the beginning, and she saw Jesus. She saw something that probably nobody in the whole land saw from the beginning, that Jesus had that power of healing,
yeah,
of doing something.
Could everybody hear him?
Yes.
Okay, good.
And it was that thought, that devotion, that was why the healing was so possible, even under such extraordinary circumstances.
So where was Jesus when he heard of Lazarus' condition? I don't think the Bible actually says physically where he was. We know it took approximately 2 days to get there, plus he tarried another 2 days.
Did we skip 2 and 3, or did we cover those?
We kind of covered 1 and 2, and we talked about 3 too, but we could go back to 3 and talk about it some more. I got this curious. She went to the market, and she bought this really expensive sandal oil, but she didn't bring a cloth or something. She used her hair.
One of the Bible references said something about long tresses of hair, and then, quote, "with which slaves wiped their master's feet." So this was not an uncommon practice. In Mary's case, I really believe that it was to demonstrate or show how that humility and worship and devotion that she was showing to the Christ, for the Christ.
I think that's a good point. It ties in, too, with what Jesus did before his crucifixion, where he washed the disciples' feet. I think she was kind of already there mentally. She understood, you know,
yes,
what it meant to serve.
Yeah. And I never read this before, but that perfume was worth a year's worth of wages, over $10,000 plus. Which I never heard. I'd read that in a commentary. That's how expensive that was, which it goes back to, if someone said that they were well-to-do, they were well-to-do. And they also, as we talked about last week, this family and Mary and Martha were two that took care of Jesus, helped, you know, gave him food or a place to stay at times. They were like a family, like we are here, in the real sense of that word. That was a lot of money.
Well,
so she had on.
I'll throw this out just to see what you guys think. when I read this question, she perfumed Jesus' feet and wiped them with her hairs. You know, feet frequently relates to your spiritual understanding, and your hairs of your head relate to the thoughts in your mind. So I got the idea of Mary's sincere desire for the Christ understanding. And that's what came to me by reading this.
What came to me is because she was so loved and respected Jesus that she brought the oil and used her own hair.
Yes, thank you.
Welcome. Thank you.
Yeah. No, it was a tremendous show of humility and respect and devotion.
And what does this all mean for us now? We've talked about it before, but... This is the attitude, the beatitude, the supreme state of thought that you should approach the Christ, that you should approach healing. If you really want a healing, this is the state of mind you should be in. You know, I've seen it even more recently. People have had tremendous healings, and then they come demanding things or. Not in this state of awe and humility. And this is after a healing. Certainly before a healing. In order to be receptive to a healing, you need to have this state of thought. Total humility and on your knees. Not coming in arrogantly or demanding things, or you're a Christian Scientist, so therefore you deserve everything, or whatever else might come. But this state of thought, and in Science and Health, when it talks about divine love, instantaneous healing, it talks about the receptive thought, it's instantaneous. That receptivity is a huge, huge word in there, and especially people who are looking for this instantaneous healing. If you want one, and if you're in that state, you probably will get it. But most people aren't there, and they need to be. So, remember this. You don't approach the Christ, the throne of grace, healing, without this. And it's truly what made Mary, I mean, we've talked about that too, one of the greatest, if you want to use that word, disciples. She was the one who was able to see the Christ in this state of utter devotion and humility.
And the real question is, are you worthy to unloose the latchet of his sandal?
I like part of the... Go ahead.
No, you go.
I was just going to talk about that she bought this costly oil, and we know that Jesus wouldn't really have cared about things or stuff, so it would have been easy just to be cheap and just think in the act, but the fact that she bought such an expensive, I think one of the disciples even complained, and that miserly sense to me is something to really think about.
Right.
It would be easy to kind of be cheap.
Yeah, it was Judas. And she was ready to give everything that much. And, you know...
I think that's a really good point, that she really was willing to subject everything she had. I mean, her hair was probably her crowning glory, and she didn't matter. It didn't matter. All of it was nothing compared to the Christ.
Yes.
And also, I don't think what the oil cost, what I cost a million or a dime, really mattered so much to Jesus. But he saw the thought behind it. Her love for Christ, like Mary said before, was what Jesus saw. Not much of the cost of the oil, because there was another incident in the Bible where people of many riches were given to the house of God. And there was another woman also who was very poor among them. She gave the least of everyone that gave everything. But Jesus said that she gave most.
Yeah, that was the widow's mite.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was the love behind it. What she did was actually mean much to Jesus.
Not the price.
Because she can't afford it anyway.
Now, I've used this example before, but I'll use it again. You know, when Jeremy came here and had such a tremendous healing, which most of you have heard about now, I mean, he has devoted his life to this. Nor have there ever been any arrogant demands about anything that he receive, anything, really. And he's one example. You are all examples. All of you have come here. You've been healed. And you are, in many ways, devoting your life to this. That is its relevance to us today, is that if we've had a healing, if we've touched Christ's hem in huge humility and devotion, then we are, if we've really gotten it, we are ready to devote ourselves to this cause, to sharing it with others so that others may be blessed as we have been blessed, and without any thought of demanding anything. That someone told me recently, and I forget which one, I think it might have been you, Alan, anyway, about a church, and it was going downhill, their branch church, because they were having to give salaries to so many people who had come. Now, that isn't necessarily a bad thing, but one to be, not to be demanded anyway, a salary, or, you know, I'll work for church if you give me a salary. You work for church because you love God, and if you get anything in return, that's beside the point. This is an attitude, a beatitude, a way to show our great devotion to God.
You know, there's something very special about Mary, this devotion to the Christ. Because, you know, we have on our website the Gospel of Mary, and it indicates in that story that Jesus confided things with her that he didn't open up with the rest of the disciples. So evidently there was an element of receptivity, devotion, trust, whatever it is there, that he even had private conversations with her, not with the other disciples. So she's pretty special. The way you're going about things.
The more receptivity you are, the more of the Christ you will receive, the more understanding it'll come flooding in to you in many, many ways. You know, there's that story where someone came to Mrs. Eddy, and she was all very stylishly dressed, and she came to see Mrs. Eddy and speak to her, and Mrs. Eddy surmised her state of thought, and she just talked to her about what lovely clothes she had, and that was it. And then the woman left. The woman was not receptive. She was into her materiality. But if you're not, and if you are receptive, you will receive more. A practitioner, I mean, I can tell when I speak to people how much I say or give, depending on how much they can receive and take. So the more receptive you are, the more you will receive. And you won't just receive it, certainly not just from the practitioner. It'll be in things you read. It'll be in other people you talk to. Suddenly, you'll find God everywhere. And more becomes revealed to you. And it is a wonderful, wonderful thing.
You know, when I was reading this story, I had a question that I couldn't answer anywhere. Was about Lazarus. When Jesus got the news about Lazarus that he had passed away, he was very, very far away. I mean, doing his work, it took him days to get there. Then I was asking, why didn't Jesus just send his message like he usually do? I mean, there were two cases in the Bible, I believe, where he told somebody, go, your child or your servant will be healed. and that person was healed at that very time that Jesus did so. But in this case of Lazarus, he didn't send that message like he usually do. He decided to go by himself. I think it means how much this family means to him. They were very good friends to Jesus that he wanted to go and also to prove something to people that death is not real. Even though Lazarus spent 3 days in there, and it took Jesus about 3 days to get there, and he still told them he was sleeping, and he gave him up. But I was wondering, well, how come he didn't send the message like he usually do? People, go, Lazarus will be awake by the time you get home. But he chose to go there by himself, even though it was going to take him too long.
Yeah, and once you have that relationship, when you have a friend in Christ, that relationship, it should be so cherished because it is something very, very special. And of course, Lazarus and Mary and Martha knew that, and Jesus did too. And Mrs. Eddy says that the two greatest miracles on earth, well, one of them is an unbroken friendship.
Well, Jesus had departed after he spoke up to the Pharisees so strongly, when he told them they were not his sheep, that they sought to stone him, they started stoning him. And that's when he went away beyond Jordan, where he was when this message about Lazarus came to him. He was beyond Jordan in the place where John the Baptist had at first baptized, and he was abiding there, and people were coming to him there. But he had gone away.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, it's interesting.
Go ahead.
It's interesting that it said he abode another 2 days in that place, even after hearing Lazarus was sick, that he didn't immediately rush over. And I wondered about that. He was about to do his greatest work, this incredible healing after many days after he'd passed on, and maybe it was in preparation for that, and or maybe it was just to prove that he didn't need to be there while he was still sick, that he could actually raise him up from the dead.
And his disciples tried to persuade him not to go. His disciples said, "The Jews of late sought to stone thee, Master, and goest thou thither again?"
It was a very dangerous.
Of course he went. Of course he went.
Right, and I think it's important to remember here, he never went anywhere without being told by God, without being sent by God. This was near the end of his mission. He knew that he was going to be crucified.
Yeah.
He knew where that would take place. And this was just before his apprehension and eventual crucifixion. And that's why he went, because God, he knew that that was part of his mission and the final part of his mission. And it was out of obedience to God that he went to the most dangerous place on earth that he could possibly go to.
And for us today, it's an example of his poise. I mean, think of it. If you ever get some untoward message about something or someone, do you go, oh my gosh, what am I going to do? I got to run, I got to get there right away. Or do you have a sense of peace and dominion, God's presence and power, and to be listening and to go, as Gary said, when you are sent, if you need to go? It's the stately goings of mind. So you can ask yourself, beware of that. If you ever feel all anxious and like you've got to run somewhere or do something, perhaps it's because you think you're doing it and you're not knowing that it is God that's doing it. This is, again, another state of thought for healing, receptivity, one of poise and peace and total confidence in God's healing power.
That's a good point. If you're ever feeling in a rush or panicked about something, it's a good sign that you're not prepared to really listen to God or to be
exactly.
doing, you know, doing what you need to do when you need to do it, which is what you talked about in the article of obedience, either acting too late or too soon.
Yeah, thank you. And if you're living it moment by moment, obeying God, you won't be never off guard. You won't be off guard. You won't be thrown off balance. It's only if you're out, you know, doing things probably shouldn't be that you get thrown off that way and get all excitable and worried and rushing madly around. So this is the importance of never absent from your post, never off guard, never ill-humored, never unready to work for God. It gives you that poise and peace. So you realize the total unreality of any problem and the total omniscience and omnipresence and omnipotence of God Almighty.
What came to me, the reason Jesus waited 2 days was to allow time for them to come to terms with their unbelief. The atmosphere was not the right time for Jesus to come. That's what came to me.
Okay, thank you, Ken.
Thank you, too.
So that kind of answers question number six that I was getting at there, why Jesus. But let's go back to four first. I think I heard the answer earlier. Where was Jesus when I heard of Lazarus' condition? I think someone said it was beyond the Jordan.
Yeah, I think Fairley told that pretty well.
Yeah, he was out in the boondocks.
The wilderness.
The wilderness.
It's interesting that they knew where he was so they could send a message to him.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, a lot of people were going to him there to be healed and to be taught.
Yeah, and there again, he was not out of reach, which was another sign of his caring for everyone. He wasn't somewhere where no one knew where he was or how to reach him. And they didn't, of course, have cell phones in those days.
No, but I think it's important. You know, this was near the end of his mission. He had spent 3 years traveling around healing and teaching. And by now, he was a very famous person. So people knew where he was.
He was a ways away.
Yeah, he was a ways away.
I think that was interesting. I believe that was the guy that stayed there. He knew the danger that was facing him because, you know, he knew he was going to get arrested when he go over there. They don't want him because they have accused him of something before they throw stuff on him. And that was why he went over the right side of Jordan. But he knew also there could be trouble when he go over there, but he didn't mind because his friend Lazarus was sick, and he told his disciple, "Our friend was asleep, let's go and wake him up."
So question number five, thank you, Benjamin. So why did he say Lazarus was sleeping initially? He sleepeth.
He didn't, like, for him, that was not real. He never see that as real. Even for himself, he said, this body, this is not exactly how he said it, but he said, we drop this body, and I will pick it up in 3 days, right? And he never recognized that as real. In many instances,
he thought he was asleep.
Go ahead.
Disciples, when he said sleep, he thought that Lazarus was really snoozing.
Yeah, I read that, and it was a common referral to death in ancient Jewish thought.
Oh, really?
But I mean, I think also what Benjamin said is true, too. He knew that he wasn't really dead, so to speak.
Yeah, I mean, he was instructing his disciples. And in science, that's what was really going on. He was asleep.
Yeah, and it's the Adam dream that a person needs to be awakened from, sleep.
And his disciples had seen him raise others from the dead. And yet, they still didn't seem to get the science.
Yes. So that leads to question number six. Jesus says, "I'm glad for your sakes I was not there, to the intent that ye may believe." He was speaking to disciples specifically. What was he saying there?
This is Ken. I just wanted to elaborate on a five that came to me, too, because Jesus knew that he had never died. As other people close to Lazarus believed he had died, And that came to me strongly. So I just wanted to share that.
Thank you, Stan. That was a great point.
Okay, well, anyone with a question Shahida just asked? Jesus was glad he wasn't there. Let's see.
Yes, because
go ahead, Linda. Was that Linda?
No, I think I heard Shardy. Let her go first.
Well, what I thought was that he knew that he was going to raise Lazarus, and it was all to the point.
Sorry.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
He was saying to his disciples, I was glad I was not there because he knew what he was going to do. And if he had been there, he would have been expected to heal Lazarus. And because he wasn't, he had this opportunity to show this glorification that God heals no matter what, and that Lazarus never died.
Thank you.
Ms. Tom, so I also think that this is in the broader context, because Jesus knew that soon he wasn't going to be around everybody.
Right.
I think it also prepared them to believe in his, or to, you know, be ready to accept his resurrection.
Yeah.
It's going to be essentially the same amount of time. And there was still this lingering belief with the disciples that, yeah, you can raise him from the dead if you're kind of right there when it's happening. But, you know, the more time that passes in between, the less anyone's faith that that could actually take place. It's kind of like, well, no, you've waited too long.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, quite a
moment.
Cool.
And there was a very...
Fairly, go ahead. Were you trying to say something, Fairly?
Oh, well, I was just going to say that the length of time pointed to his own resurrection. Lazarus was in the grave 4 days. Jesus would be raised in 3 days. But it was making a major point, really, this final healing of the dead.
Thank you.
Well, it was also the point that they were dealing with a decaying body as opposed to the quick, almost instantaneous healing of death right there pretty much on the spot with the other two. And this one, they said he had actually been dead more like 6 days because it's 4 in the grave and 2 to prepare for burial. So they knew they were dealing with a decayed body.
Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, there was a very strong medical belief at the time that if a person passed on, that it wasn't impossible for them to come back as long as it was within, like, a 3-day period. But the belief was, after 3 days, it was impossible to ever come back.
I found that as well. Thank you.
And Jesus said to Martha, thy brother shall rise again. And Martha said unto him, I know that he'll rise again in the resurrection at the last day, you know, her normal belief. But Jesus then, that's when he said, I am the resurrection and the life. He that believeth on me, though he were dead, yet shall he live. There again, he's trying to explain himself of what he represents, the Christ.
Yeah, and what is the I that he referred to?
The Christ. It's his bringing the Christ.
Right. He wasn't referring to the human
person,
Jesus.
No.
Thank you.
Also, I think he was breaking down some wrong interpretations about some religious belief that there was some final resurrection was going to happen in some day or whatever like that. A lot of Christians today, I think, even think that. But it ain't going to happen. That's not it. Now is the time to work out your salvation. I think Jesus was clarifying that misconception at that point, too.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
one of the things I liked from the commentary was they mentioned that the disciples followed the Christ even though it didn't make sense to them, which would be like going back to this area where he was in danger. But they were trusting and followed him.
Thomas, it's even said it in the Bible, Thomas said, well, let's go and die with him.
One of the things that hit me on this question was that in some of the other Bible stories where God is saving, for example, I think it was likely he was saving Jericho, or there were several other instances where he narrowed down the number of people that did it, so it would prove that God saved the city or God did the miracle. Yeah. And going past the 3 days on Lazarus, there's not going to be any doubt that it was the Christ that did the healing, and not that he happened to be there and the body would wake up on its own anyway. There would be absolutely no doubt at all that God, Christ, did this.
Thank you.
Yeah, it must have really shattered, like, personal sense that people had of him. It wasn't just this guy I know doing stuff. It was something a lot more than that.
Yeah. Yeah, it really, really true. They could have to attribute it to a principle working, not just some nice guy, but God, principle of life.
Let's move on to the next question.
Yes.
So it's been talked about a little bit earlier. This is a pivotal healing, considered a pivotal healing in Jesus' ministry. But looking at this, can we think about the story about the other healings of people who had supposedly died, including Jairus' daughter and the man from Nain. First of all, do you have a timeline as to which came when, which was first? Anybody look that up?
I think the daughter that was raised from the dead first.
That's what I showed.
Tom, do you know?
No.
Okay, well, that sounds good to me. I don't know either.
One commentary noted that they came kind of progressively. So the daughter that was raised, that was almost like an instantaneous healing from death. And then the second one was a little more prolonged, that they came in that order, almost showing was doing them in that order, progressively showing these higher healings.
That's a really good point. So the man from Nain, for example, who's about to be going to his burial, the daughter who had just passed, who was on the brink of it, and then Lazarus, who was already in his tomb, there was definitely a progression there.
Yeah.
Also, there's the progression of Jesus telling the people about, in the Jairus healing in the name, not to tell anyone because he wasn't ready to confront the people who were trying to stone him and do away with him.
Yes.
I hadn't thought about that, but that's a good point.
Mm-hmm. In the daughter's healing, he also said she's not dead but sleepeth. So he used that same expression about sleeping.
Correct.
Yeah, and it is a good way to think of any problem. It's a form of sleep, a form of mesmerism that you need to be awakened from, not the reality of being. I found a little history on that Nain village, which I thought was sort of interesting. It was a little village in Galilee up a steep road, and in 380 A.D., someone went there, made a pilgrimage there, and it said the house of the widow and the place where they were going to lay him was still there. And then after the fall of the Latin kingdom, Nain became a Muslim village. And then in 1664, it was just full of Arab families, and someone who visited said there was no sign of the house or anything at that point. But then in 1880, the Franciscans went into the city, and they said they were helped by a very simple, honest Muslim, one of the leaders of the town, with a good heart, they said. And even though the place there had been totally taken over and the church had been changed into a mosque, they allowed these people to build a little small rectangular church in which they had paintings that depicted the miraculous healing of the widow's son being healed. And it said the church is still open today, but you can rarely get into it because the Franciscans have the key and they live on the top of Mount Tabor. But I just thought it was kind of an interesting history of that little town. Because I'm sure I'll never get there, but... Shahida, anything?
I'm sorry, I have to jump off now, so I wanted to say goodbye to everybody. I had to leave a little early, so thank you, guys.
Oh, glad you could join us. Thank you.
Glad I could for a few, too.
Thank you. I would like to add one thing.
Go ahead, Fairley.
The healing of Lazarus, as we said, was pivotal, as she pointed out. It was specifically pivotal, too, because after it, the chief priests and Pharisees had a council. They drew together and had a council together and said, what are we going to do? For this man doeth many miracles. If we let him thus alone, all men will believe on him, and the Romans shall come and take away both our place and our nation. And that's when Caiaphas said, you know, that one man should die for the people. And this, he prophesied that Jesus should die for the nation. And from that day forth, they took counsel to put him to death. And then they also wanted to put Lazarus to death because so many people were influenced by it. Much people of the Jews, therefore, knew that he was there, and they came not for Jesus' sake only, but that they might see Lazarus, whom he had raised from the dead.
Thank you. That's wonderful. Thank you, Fairley. It paints the picture of what a hot time this was. And here, this wonderful, people call it a miracle, just had been performed. And then shortly after that, Jesus was put to death. And then...
so enraged the human mind.
Yeah.
No, and the Romans came anyway. Sorry.
Romans came anyway, yes. Quite a story. Quite a story. And thank you for letting us get into it more deeply, Shahida.
Thank you all for your great comments.
I also wanted to make one other quick comment here. I thought it was interesting in the lesson where it talked about Jesus groaning in the spirit during this thing with Lazarus, that it said that he saw Mary weeping and the Jews were all weeping that were with her, and he groaned in the spirit and was troubled. And most of the commentaries just said it just showed the human side of Jesus, how he would weep when they would weep. He felt their pain and all of that. But one commentary I really appreciated, it said Jesus was shuddering in holy indignation against the awful belief of death from which the whole human family suffers.
That's the one I read. I thought it was wonderful.
And that was really good.
Yes.
Because that's the correct one.
Yeah.
His primary concern was that the science would not be understood. that his mission would just not be appreciated. That was what gave him the greatest grief. There was nothing human or personal about it.
Yeah, or sympathetic. It was this idea. Yes, he wept really at their unbelief after all that he had done. So thank you. That was a good. Thank you, Sana. Good explanation. And this whole beautiful story of the raising of Lazarus is one to consider and to take into your heart. And do you have that kind of faith and trust in God that a body that actually stinketh could be raised from the dead? And look, and then the next following is how Jesus said in the tomb he was working out the problem of being. And all his organs had shut down. All the medical beliefs were in play there. And yet he raised himself, proving that life is in God. And this is something, take this from the story with you today, the relevancy of it. Your life is in God. It's not in this human body. It is in God. And as you know that, your so-called human body will behave itself. But no, it's in God. It saves your health, your joy, your strength. Everything is in God. And it is immortal. It will continue forever. That's the truth about you. And it's time to practice this and know it now, because we can, Mrs. Eddy says.
So how do we do, Shaida?
I think we should stop right there. Mary Beth's ending was perfect.
Okay, well, thank you all. We'll look forward to Esther next week, Tom, and great to have such a good, lively group here today.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.